Welcome back after the long holiday. So what we thought we would do is to wrap up chapter 2, go through some staining techniques that's in the chapter. Some of you might be doing that already in labs. Is anybody staining up muscle with the different techniques like acid base and how things you have? All right. And then maybe think about your own topics that you might want to be presenting later on. I mean, start thinking about that, mulling it over, right? For the end of the course, just not to get caught off guard or something. Oh, Tim, do you want to address anything about the papers? It was great. Thank you for getting the papers together. The newspaper article. All right.
So the newspaper article, thank you, Kate, for bringing this to our attention.
Yes, Kate.
We didn't describe that super, super, super well when we first started the class. And so the first summary of a paper is supposed to be in layman's terms. So for all of you that are graduate students that we've been teaching everybody how to write scientifically, back that truck up and write in layman's term to be able to present this as sort of the chat about the scientific paper that anyone could understand. And that's more of a challenge for our graduate students at this point in time, probably, because we've been teaching people how to write scientifically forever. We want you to be able to also write in layman's terms. So that's what that summary is supposed to be. So, again, thanks for...
Was the second one better?
Thanks for an excellent...
Much better.
Okay.
An excellent summary.
Yeah, very good.
Great.
That's
perfect. It's not super wild. I'm just studying it
while... Someone did a study on this recently because it was like scientists thought that the average American read it like a 12th grade level, but in fact, the average American reads it at 8th grade
level.
That's really
interesting. Yeah. I know.
Like surveys have to be at a fifth grade reading level for the IRB.
Yeah.
So fifth grade reading level.
I only learned that too when writing an IRB. That's the first time I learned that as well. Writing an IRB. Why are you joking, man?
You're not smarting.
Take simple sentences.
They sent it back. They sent our survey questions back to us, and they're like, "These are too hard."
That was always the discussion I think we've had, which was they always call it the elevator talk, right? You have to try to describe what you're doing in a matter of 2 minutes. The course of an elevator ride to somebody, being able to consolidate all of your information and your take-home points and the salient points you want to make to somebody in a matter of minutes in a way that they can understand it isn't easy.
One time I explained to a student, said, well, explain it like you're explaining to your grandpa, you know, about what you're doing in the lab for an undergrad. He said, oh, my grandpa's a nuclear physicist. All right.
My grandpa's a butcher, but you can cut some meat.
Yeah, they probably know the different muscle fiber types.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why we had cadaver anatomy a couple of years ago, and, well, yeah. Weirdly, it might sound. At the end of cadaver anatomy, I told Nick and I'm going to the Kroger, if you will, and being able to know which muscle was the tender one and which muscle was part of the T-bone, which muscle was, because they're all the same across the species.
I just go by the cheapest price. That's my problem. Great. But if you want to go ahead and get started on the newspaper articles, that's great. Maybe something that's interesting to you. You know, find kind of like that, at about that level, you know. I mean, it's really kind of maybe just something explaining to the, you know, or like Science Daily, if you haven't seen Science Daily. Those are really, they take current papers and they distill it down to a simple understanding. And those are really good. And if you don't already subscribe to Science Daily, that's a good thing to do. Go on Science Daily, download, and you'll get your morning perk. You know, every day there's something really neat out there.
And then thanks for being the test case. This is the first time we've run this class, so the syllabus
has kind of
tentative written next to it for a reason, because you know, this is the first time we've run it, and some things take longer than others, and so I'm going to make a note now that I'm going to remember. Where are we going?
So what we'll kind of get through the fiber typing and talk about some different types of processes, and I know some of this is redundant, but we've already talked about. So you need to figure out how to get the screen to project everything. But I think we left off really here about the different fiber types that we were talking about. Generally, you might hear about the three general fiber types. Type 1, 2A, 2B. So what does SO stand for? Anybody?
Slow oxidative,
right? FOG? Oxidative, glycolytic. Fast glycolytic, right? So all that makes sense with the types of enzymatic processes that are going on. in these, and generally, you know, we kind of think of red, fast white over there too, but this intermediate form. Mostly we talk about, you know, 1, 2A, 2B, 2X, right? All right, so let's look at some of these other aspects. And they say that the banding pattern in the M band is actually a really good classification as well, but not that practical to then have to process the tissue and then look for the M band and get it stretched out just right. But the other staining techniques are a lot better. Let's look at some of the different staining techniques. We've went through this already, like glycolysis, right? You don't have to memorize all these steps, but we should know, you know, glycolysis goes... takes place where? Does this take place in the mitochondria? No? Cytoplasm, right? Of the cell. And then pyruvate, we get two of those. And then net ATP is 2. Total is 4. And then we go through TCA cycles, so we can stain up for different enzymatic processes in the glycolytic pathway or in the TCA cycle, electron transport chain, to look at these different muscle fiber types. And right on through. Just as a curiosity, what do we call this water at the end of the TCA electron transport chain? Anybody remember? You make water as the end product as well. It's different than just regular water we talk about drinking. So some animals, actually like the desert kangaroo rat, never has to drink water. They can just get water from actually eating carbohydrate or a little bit of moisture in the seeds. If you ever go out to like Zion National Park, and they have that little museum. You see these little desert kangaroo rats that are in the cage. And it's so cool because we were out there a couple of years back, and I thought, we talk about these in class, but we've never seen one until it was at this museum. But they never have to drink water because they can make metabolic water. So this is called metabolic water. And some animals then get their water supplied by basically breaking down carbohydrates or a little bit of moisture in the seeds, but they never have to really drink water. Isn't that amazing? Okay. So if we think about where we're getting this glucose from in muscle, right? Blood transport. Muscle can store glycogen, and the liver can store glycogen too, and you can break that down relatively quickly, get that glucose up, so you can then utilize glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain. All right, so let's think about, I don't want you to have to memorize anything here really, except that, you know, you're using the ATP and getting metabolic water, and the different staining techniques that people use. So I think we just left off last time talking about you could have these 8 different definitions. I know you can't see all that. Sorry. I wonder if I scoop this thing sideways. But then it cuts off the other side, right? There you go. But maybe more important on that side. So you could have these, but generally I think your textbook said something about 90% or 95% of all muscle really falls into these 3 groups. So you could just generally group these muscle fiber types. All right. So let's think about how these are actually stained up. So there's some really neat ways to look at muscle. Some people are using myosin heavy chain antibodies that can actually characterize. You don't have to memorize. Don't worry about memorizing tables. It's a general idea. So if you've got a question like this, open response, how would you stain muscle fiber types? You know, we'll talk about that as an open response type of question. You can stain for different myosin isoforms. And so you have different types of antibodies that will actually stain up these different types of muscle, myosin isoforms that are in the muscle, and then characterize that muscle fiber type. Anybody use myosin antibodies in your work, right? And do some of you maybe separate the myosin bands, the isoforms, by a... Yeah, with, you know, and even maybe just a... SDS page gel, you know, molecular weights, right? And you can see usually 4 bands, like in the soleus, right? And then maybe 3 in another, and you figure out which bands are which. So that's a pretty neat way to do it as well, but antibodies are pretty specific. And then there are some other ways that people can stain up these fibers by looking at type 1, 2A. Sorry, the last one over there is a 2B. And I can scoot this back and forth, I guess, unless you can see it over there. But the way that you can stain it up with this incubation with pH. So I'm not familiar with these. I haven't used these techniques on this pH. But I wanted to show this picture here if we can. Let's see if I can get this. So if you have your textbook, and I know this won't pop up on Echo, but it's kind of neat. It's on page It's in the front page. It's at C5 color figure if you happen to have the book. Maybe we can make a copy of this on the web page or the canvas. But these different staining techniques that they're using here, basically to stain up the different muscle fiber types. And remember, somewhat relative when you make the section of the muscle, depending on if you have all the fiber types in your view or not, the way it might stain up and see these slight differences. Here you could really see that there's stark differences here with the light brown and the dark brown, for example. So let's just look at some of these and see if I can find my page here. So this one, this myofibril ATPase activity, this is kind of neat because they say that you can stain it up. Let me find that page again. Yeah, pretty cool. So, ATPase carrying out under alkaline conditions, 9.4, this ATPase-based classification scheme can give them a nice staining technique. Whereas other assays performed under the increasing acidic conditions like pH 4 gives you a different measure. So what basically happens here is that, and it says right here, and it's kind of odd, it turns out that the reasons are not clear for this, but it just happens. The fast muscle fibers have a different pH sensitivity than the slow muscle myosins, thus is acid pH. Slow fibers stain more darkly than fast fibers, while the alkaline pH has just the opposite is true. So slow fibers stain more darkly than the others. So this one, I think, is E. Let's look at E over here. Is it E? Let's figure out which one. Oh, it's C over here. So this one right here. So here's your acid staining, different types of acid staining that would then show up these different fiber types. So that's pretty cool that you could stain up muscle fibers like this. Anybody use that in their lab at the pH? I don't know how easy it is or difficult.
I think it was just like before people had developed the monoclonal antibodies.
That
was the go-to
technique, but now kind of the standard is...
Just
use
the antibodies.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
So we ended up having to use it, though, in laryngeal muscle physiology and biology because the monoclonal antibodies for skeletal muscle aren't always the same as what we're looking for in laryngeal muscle. Because we have 2L laryngeal muscles and MS-13. Muscles are the fastest trichomyosin cadaver or ocular laryngeal muscle fibers.
Okay.
5 milliseconds of deep tension, 10 milliseconds of deep tension.
Sure.
They're fast. So you. So we, unfortunately, had to publish a paper with the ATPA stain.
Okay.
And then reviewers wanted to discern between myosin types. Like, you can't, right? That's a challenge. You can't really discern between them. You just go so fast as yourself. And unfortunately, they're all fast.
All fast.
So it's like,
wow, yeah. So you might have to educate the reviewers on this point if they're not familiar with it as well. So that's pretty neat.
They sometimes depend on what fix the tissue is. You can't fix it.
Oh, because it inactivates the ATPase?
On how your tissue
stores. Okay, good point. So these are all important factors to try to think about if one wanted to work through following that recipe, but there might be reasons that they made those recipes the way they did, right? So that's kind of neat. So maybe the antibodies are a better way to do this. Maybe we shouldn't really torture you with these other processes. But let's look at this other one I have here. So that's kind of neat. Oops, that's this one. There was another one that was really kind of interesting as well. Let's see where that one disappeared to. Oh, here it is, I think. Where did that go to? Oh, and like you were saying, here's the, you know, the myosin antibodies, different staining types that you can get out of that. Okay, so, and then like the different types that you can stain up for maybe the glycolytic pathways are differences in the TCA cycle. If you're going to stain up for a particular enzyme, like you just mentioned, if you inhibited those enzymes, then they're not going to stain up, right, with fixatives, for example. So you have to have the active enzyme if you wanted to stain for it. But you can see that you can get some pretty nice staining patterns. I don't want you to have to memorize these differences. B is this dystrophin, which is kind of neat. So remember we talked about dystrophin being at the border of the muscle fiber membrane to the contractile elements inside, pretty much like to the Z disc. And you can see that staining pattern as well. So that's pretty neat to think about. All right, and we just had a seminar. If you're not familiar with the Center of Muscle Biology and their weekly seminar series on Thursdays, usually from 11 to 12, we had an interesting talk last week by a gentleman that was looking at automating classification of muscle fiber types. So we'd actually take a picture of this, digitize it, and then try to classify the muscle fiber diameters and sizes so he could actually go in and try to very quickly with mass imaging get the outline of the muscle fiber so he could look at cross-sectional area quickly instead of doing it by hand, so automating it. And then if one stained up fibers, then the density differences, he could then classify them relatively quickly. So he's trying to develop software that could do that without so many errors that are out there already in the software. Some of you saw that talk, right? So he's really into the computer programming, it seemed like, and he's really making some headway. And I think the Center of Muscle Biology is now putting that software out there for the world to use, and it's an improvement on what's available right now. So it should be something that puts UK on the map in muscle biology in the sense of automating your fiber cross-sections and seeing if it changes in disease states or not, but also to be able to look at different staining patterns and look at the densities, and then you could quickly assay what fiber types are there and the percents and if it changes under different conditions. So that's pretty cool. So not to memorize these different patterns, but to get the idea that you could stain them up for different conditions. All right, so that's kind of the take home of that. All right. So contraction velocity, too. You could classify muscle fiber types like this, like you were just saying, I think, with the ocular muscle. Is that the fastest one, basically, in the body?
Or? It seems to be, yes.
Okay. And that one's very odd, too. I think Paco Andrade, Francisco Andrade in physiology, used to work in the eye muscles. Yeah. He still does, I guess. Okay. And that's a very odd muscle in our body, too, if... What I'm familiar with is not so much the fiber type, but that it can have, you know, most of your skeletal muscles are innervated by one type of motor neuron, right, to that muscle fiber usually in the belly. But in your eye, you can actually have dually innervated muscle fibers. So you have innervation on the borders of that muscle as well as in the belly, and it's a different type of motor neuron. Now, that's really unusual. And the idea is that this is a different type of muscle embryologically in origin where you're somatic muscles for your skeletal muscles, but these come from a different embryological origin, so it's different.
So you're saying on the same muscle fiber, it has two neurons connected to this motor unit?
Yeah, so if this was your eye muscle here, then you'd have innervation here by one type, and you could have innervation to the edges on it with a different motor neuron type, which is odd for us because usually it's just one motor neuron right into the belly of the muscle. I don't know if it's more than two or...
It can be more than two.
There's
a beautiful paper, some beautiful units of chemistry that shows multiple intermuscular junctions along one fiber. Several images in that paper came out of Wisconsin, I think, right there. It's a really elegant picture. It's a unique system that nobody quite really understands that for long. It's for a velocity of contraction, if it's for an evolutionary trait, so if you lose some motor neurons, you still have function because these are so important. And nobody's traced them back yet.
Really?
Which is why I talked to Richie and Fiona about it. Why haven't we traced these things back?
Find out where they're going. Yeah. Right. That'd be really neat, embryologically how they're coming about. And this is a spared in some disease states, too. Your ocular muscles are spared in some disease states compared to yourself.
That's where it was first discovered, was muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. So during muscular dystrophy, people with Duchenne muscular dystrophy can still see and can still talk. So those muscles are spared. And in part because embryonically, the connective protein is utrophin, not so much dystrophin. And as you come out of fetal development, that's replaced with dystrophin. But in the laryngeal and the ocular muscles, utrophin still remains. So if you don't have dystrophin, still have a connection between your cerebellum and your basement membrane, the fusion.
That's very cool.
And so if we try to do dystrophin staining on those muscles, it's patchy.
Neat. Essentially neat. That's very.
I'll find that paper and post it on there. Even the image alone.
Really just something to see. It's really quite fascinating. So again, on the contraction properties, then you can. Oops, I'm sorry. You have to yell at me. He's off on a tangent again. All right. It should pop up here in a sec. There we go. Contraction velocities, right? And so the fiber types, they fit with what we were just talking about, slow, right, versus fast muscle fiber types. That's generally that classification as well. And the 2X being really quite fast, 2A, 2X. And we've kind of already talked about this, just a little bit of a repeat. We'll look at this M bridge pattern. I've kind of looked at these figures, and the ones that are in the text, I find that to be a little hard to pull it out myself, but here, we'll look at it again together in case you don't have the same thing. Are we seeing this? Yeah, so these bridges that are in the M-band, right? Remember where the M-band is? What's the M-band stand for? Where is that structurally? You better remember. Z-disc, right? Actin, myosin between, and then the myosin heads come off, and the M-band's right in the middle because the myosin heads can't. Come together right there, so there's a little band in the middle of the A. And so if we're looking at these little bridges, which I find hard to see in this figure, but I guess they're there, maybe. And this is why the textbook says that this is one way to separate out muscle fiber types. This is type 1, type 2A, type 2B, but that it's a bit difficult to do that every time, and you'd have to have good sections to be able to see that type. But that was pretty definitive approach as well. I like the idea of antibody staining better. But if some muscles can't do that, then maybe, this would be neat. Maybe the ocular muscles have something even more odd. I don't know if anybody's looked at it in different ways, and that could be something new. Maybe a project for somebody that wants to work on that, right? You never know. Maybe you'd find something unusual. Don't assume that everything is known, right? In biology or medicine, there's always new things being discovered all the time, something that somebody's overlooked, and you can make a contribution by working on that, mini project, right? So don't think that everything's out there that's been solved. There's lots of neat things to still work at. So, sorry to be bouncing back and forth here. We'll see what happens. And then some of the staining patterns that they've had. So we're just kind of wrapping up this chapter a bit. Looking at that with fiber size and this staining types, like with this activity for slow muscle or fast muscle, and you can see that the fiber size is kind of correlating with the type of muscle as well. So 2B were these larger size muscles, and the type 1 and 2A, this mixed muscle group right in here, were the smaller size muscles. And so that's kind of interesting too, that you could think of the different the large muscles and the smaller muscles being of different fiber types as well. I don't know if that holds true in all animals or not, but generally, is that pretty true throughout as far as we know? Anybody do any of this? We believe. Generally. So here's those little bridges. Sorry, I could have just pulled this up, I guess. That are down the M-band here. Right? And I find it a little bit hard to see them, but anyways, they can. Yeah, I guess this makes it a little clearer. but I find it difficult to see these banding patterns, but anyways. All right. And maybe that's why it is difficult. So if we look at these innervation patterns, too, this is neat because you think about why they got these other names, too, fast and slow. Right, slow muscle fibers, right, slow oxidative red muscle fibers, and fast muscle fibers, but they fatigue quickly. And then we look at the muscle types or the banding patterns, and then we can also look at the physiology. So if you're looking at fatigues, twitching muscle, right, so it twitches fast, and then the slow
In this, it's showing maybe it doesn't release as much tension, but as far as I know, these little muscles could reach pretty high tension also, right? And I think this might be a little bit of confusion sometimes, because slow muscle can generate a lot of force as well. Right? Is that generally the...
Isometrically. So mechanically, cross-bridge isometrically should produce the same force irrespective of its fiber tapping, because fiber tapping has to be movement.
Right.
A 6 piconewtons of force cross-bridge is relatively well accepted with a current movement.
But it's the amount of muscle that we're having here in the total muscle mass, so for the force of that, so the individual muscle fibers should generate the same force close to it. We'll get that with Kent Campbell later on. Maybe he'll clarify that a bit more. All right. But then you can see larger muscles then with a fast twitch could generate a lot of force in this figure. But also what you see here is the innervation pattern to the middle of the muscle fibers and also the fatigue. So fast fatigue muscles, slow fatigue, it doesn't fatigue out, can keep going, kind of like your neck muscles, keep your head up, right? Frame muscles, unless you're, totally bored and your head is so heavy it falls over to the side, can't keep it up. So it can keep going for a long period of time. We'll talk a little bit about that, too, on the, if you measured electrical responses, they correlate with this as well, right, in the muscle depolarization. So you could look at the muscle will depolarize, and if you repeatedly stimulate it, you will see that it starts to fail in action potentials as well. So it's kind of interesting. Is it really the muscle, or is it the innervation pattern? Is it the nerve, or is it the muscle, right? So this is why people get rid of the nerve and stimulate the muscle directly, so you don't have the problem of synaptic transmission. And that's interesting, too. We'll talk about that later on some later lecture about comparative muscle fibers in other animals, but in some animals and invertebrates, you can actually have a muscle fiber, a single muscle fiber, innervated by phasic and tonic motor neurons on the same muscle fiber. You can repetitively stimulate the phasic one and look at the fatigue of the EPSPs, like the excitatory synaptic responses. They're non-spiking muscle fibers, so they don't make an action potential. So it's a graded depolarization in the muscle fiber. And you repetitively stimulate it. Like these muscles, just to kind of remember, right? We produce action potentials in these muscles. Action potential goes down to both directions on the muscle fiber. So it's not a graded response, it just hits both threshold and boom, you get an action potential on the muscle fiber. Many invertebrates do not make action potentials on the muscle fibers, so it's a graded response. So you can actually see that electrical response quickly drop out with repetitive stimulation for a basic type of muscle fiber, but a slow muscle fiber. If you stab that muscle fiber, you can repetitively stimulate it, and it maintains that synaptic response on the muscle fiber. But if you had a dually innervated muscle fiber by a basic and tonic on the same muscle fiber that you stab, you can depress the basic, repetitively stimulating the motor neuron. You can depress the EPSP, the excitatory postsynaptic potential. And then just, and you think, oh, that muscle's kind of, it's not pulling the force anymore with that basic stimulation. And then just switch over and stimulate the tonic motor nerve to that muscle fiber. And then all of a sudden you see synaptic responses and great depolarization, and the muscle starts to build force up again. So it's not the muscle fiber that's fatigued in that case, it's really the motor nerve term that's depressed, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about, like we've talked about with fatigue before. Where's the fatigue, right? And so this is why you want to get away from the nervous system having a contribution if you want to just look at the muscle fiber itself, so stimulating the muscle fiber directly. All right. So we've talked about these general points again about the type of stimulation, right? And fatigue-resistant versus fatigue, that muscle can fatigue relatively quickly. Fatigue resistant are slow in that sense that it won't fatigue. Okay, so the staining patterns we've already talked about. And just to remind you then, if you look at the muscle fiber in mammalian muscles, then we have an action potential that travels along that muscle fiber, then we start to get the tension built up, right? Because the action potential does what? Just to refresh, right? Goes down the T2 wheel. right? You've got that down. They haven't locked you up yet by talking to yourself while you're walking down the street trying to memorize all that, right? Okay. All right, so I think that... let's see what else is happening here. I just pulled these out of the... I think we're done with that. So, oh yeah, this is another neat way of staining muscle fibers. So if you wanted to look at the innervation pattern to a muscle, let's say you had a mixed muscle, and you wanted to find out how many were activated by that particular motor unit, an easy way to do that is to repetitively stimulate that motor unit, and then look at the utilization of glycogen in that muscle fiber. So you could, well, it's kind of difficult since you can't do it before and after, right? Because you've already stimulated and fixed it. But you could repetitively stimulate that motor unit, and you could see depletion of the glycogen stores in that particular muscle, and then you would know which muscle units were actually being fired, and which muscle fibers were used in that mixed muscle, for example. So you could actually repetitively stimulate that motor unit and look at that. That's kind of a neat way to stain up the muscle fibers as well. But the more glycogen you have, the longer it can continue to fire, right? Because you're utilizing those stores over time, and a rapid way to break down the glycogen to get glucose for utilization. So if we talk about diet, and I think we might have somebody talking about diet specifically later on in the course about energy, maybe, I'm not sure. Esther sometimes talks about it, but it might be a side thing that she's kind of interested in as well. So if we had, this is neat, so after exercise, if you were eating fat and protein diet, you never really got your glycogen levels back up again, right? So you wonder about some people that are on these different diets. The text really doesn't mention it, but some people that are, you know, now on these diets as kids or maybe solving epilepsy problem. You've heard of the ketogenic diet, right, where it's high-fat diet. And then you wonder about how well they can function maybe with muscle. Maybe they don't have a lot of glycogen. They might fatigue quicker. But then if they're not having epileptic seizures, that's pretty good too, right? So maybe that's a trade-off. Versus if you had a carbohydrate diet, you could get that stores and you exercise, you can actually build up more carbohydrates than what you initially had. As a personal note, I used to think that the Gandhi diet was a really good approach just to, you know, kind of like, okay, shut down, just not going to eat. That's, you know, if you don't eat, you're going to lose weight, right? So that would be a really good way to do it. So you just kind of like cut yourself down. My wife kept just getting onto me about portions, you know, so I keep cutting down portions and then just kind of go out of starvation fast for like 24, 48 hours. Oh my God, does that drive you crazy? But then you kind of like say, nope, can't do this Gandhi fast, you know, and then you start eating. And I gained more weight than when I had started the darn fast. So then I read some papers and say, well, this is what happens when you do that. And I'm like, okay, maybe I should have researched this first. But you know, it was really a bad approach. So now I just drink more coffee and hope it increases metabolism. That's one way to do it. But this was a neat aspect. On a comparative basis, it's really interesting if you look at migratory birds and glycogen. People have looked at birds that migrate, like the Arctic tern is one of the largest, you know, migratory bird that goes the farthest way from the Arctic all the way down to South America. They look at the glycogen stores in the Arctic terns while they're migrating, and you can see that they're depleting their stores, and they get down to about Iowa somewhere, and they have to restore up again because they don't have enough glycogen to make the next trip or across the Gulf of Mexico, which is really something else. And if they don't have those feeding places, then they won't be able to make their migration. So a lot of those places are being destroyed, right? And so they're wondering about these migrations that are occurring with birds, for example, that they won't be able to have enough food reserves to pick up because those wetlands are being destroyed. So it's kind of an interesting aspect, too, to think of how animals function and migrate, for example, throughout their environment. So, let's see, well, there was something, oh, this was what we were already talking about with trying to look at units and this maximum velocity of contraction, for example, and motor unit firing rate. So, you know, how much you can actually get out of these motor units. There's some limit to firing the motor units, right? How fast you can fire. And some of this we talked about, it's not the refractor period of the motor neurons, right? The refractor period of an action potential in a neuron, right, is really limited by what? like how fast you can sense something if you repetitively hit your skin, right? What's kind of the limiting factor of a neuron with electrical activity? Any idea? Sodium pump, kind of, but so when you have an action potential down the nerve, what makes the upstroke of the action potential? Remember the action potential? I know. Neurons. you know, the upstroke is due to what? Here's a cell, neuron, infrasire electrode in there. What happens? How does it get, why does it get to this level right here, let's say? What happens right here?
This is the threshold, the influx of sodium.
Right, exactly. So this is the threshold of the voltage-gated sodium channels that are in the membrane. Boom, we fired them. Goes up. Yeah, remember, I don't know, and you don't have to memorize it, but like E sodium, that's the equilibrium value for sodium, right? It's trying to go to the equilibrium value, but it doesn't quite make it. Why does it not make it? And it starts to come back down. Your neurons, your action potential neurons. So what's the, why does it not go all the way to the E sodium, which it's trying to do, because sodium's going in the cell, concentration gradient, sodium's higher outside. Right? This is the same for the muscle fiber, but it's easier to maybe think about it in the...
There's a balance of potassium.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That causes the shift.
So, potassium, and this is what we usually think about, the voltage-gated sodium channels are right here. That's a threshold. But you have another threshold, and that's the voltage-gated potassium channels. So, the potassium channels also keep opening up at a particular voltage. So if we start to open up the voltage-gated potassium channels, the potassium's going to do what? The potassium's higher on the inside, it's going to go out, right? Sodium's going to go in just on the concentration gradient. But there's also this electrical gradient. So it's always a concentration electrical gradient. But the E-potassium is down here somewhere, so the equilibrium for potassium ions. So we are going to open up the potassium channels. Potassium now is going to flow out, which counteracts the sodium, right? So it really is not going to go up here. But there's something very unique about sodium channels. What's the uniqueness about sodium channels, voltage-gated sodium channels? After they open, they
close.
Get closed, but the real word might be inactivation. So they inactivate, so we're getting sodium channel inactivation. So sodium channels are being inactivated, and then what's still open? Potassium channels. So if we bring it back down towards the E-potassium, depends on the neuron. Not all neurons are like that textbook case that you see in many textbooks where it hyperpolarizes below the resting membrane potential. It can only hyperpolarize if E-potassium is below the resting membrane potential. But for many neurons, the E-potassium is very close to the resting membrane potential, so your action potential might just come back down to resting membrane potential. All right? So these voltage-gated potassium channels open, bring it down. This is a refractory period for the voltage-gated sodium channels. You can't fire, and if we're stimulating the nerve, if we stimulate it over here, we wouldn't be able to generate another action potential. But the longer we wait, you stimulate it again, now you might get a little bored of action potential. You wait longer, and then now you can maybe get the full action potential back again. This refractory period from here to here is the refractive period, which is due to the voltage-gated sodium channels being inactive. When you can't get, let's say we stimulated here again, and we couldn't get an action potential, this period is the absolute refractive period. And from the time you can start to get something to getting a full recovery, that's the relative refractive period. Okay, and it's all due to voltage-gated sodium channels. So the same idea with muscle, it's not really the nerve that's limiting the rate of muscle contraction and stimulation. It's really the muscle itself, right? And what's the limiting factor with muscle relaxing, contracting again? The calcium and ATPase for taking even the calcium back up into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Because remember, like that boatfish that we were talking about, rattlesnake? Remember that? The papers? You know, getting that calcium back buffered back up again, too. So it's not really the nerve. Sometimes people get confused with that because they remember the refractory period of the motor neuron. It's really not that that's limiting the speed of contractions. It's the muscle fiber types. Okay, so EMG activity. Do some people record EMGs in muscles?
Yeah,
Right. Do you use surface electrodes? Or
surface.
So just on the surface, and it's pretty good? You get noise? Or
a lot of noise for what I was trying to do. A very static contraction. Slow. It's a very minimal contraction.
Okay. And so the text was mentioning about some problems with EMGs, about not being the best approach, maybe with muscle fiber types. And is it because that you can't really pull out mixed fibers very well, things like that, right? We had a class in the summertime when we had animal phys that was a small class, and it would contact people like in the neurology, Grand Brown, so we could take people to it. So there was a person, Steve Ryan, he's super, I don't know if you know him, he's over in the VA hospital, he's a neurologist. And so he let our class go on over. I asked him, so can we, there's only like 15 students, we used to go to the Grand Rounds in neurology. It was really fun because if you ever want a good snack in the morning, find out when the Grand Rounds are, because they have all the kind of foods. These sales reps come in and they like provide them with great things, bananas, oranges, donuts, good donuts. And so we debated that. But then he said, okay, we'll do the EMG recording because we were talking about it. And we were going to take a guinea pig in the class, but then he said, no, we can't do that. It's against HIPAA rules. But instead, your instructor volunteered for this. So, yes, I volunteered. Because I didn't have a choice. So he actually put these electrodes into the muscle. Well, actually, we had a resident come in and do this. So I lift my leg up, and then he stabbed these muscles in the back right here. And the resident was saying, okay, so you got this activity. He said, what do you mean you got this activity? And I said, it feels like you're stimulating. And the resident actually said, no, we're not stimulating. That's your intrinsic muscle activity. But Ryan took the resident out, kind of outside the class. He said, wait a minute. He went outside the class and we could hear him saying, what do you mean you're not stimulating? Of course you're stimulating. Don't you understand what we're doing? And so we thought, oh my God, you should have the resident. But the thing was, they were stimulating at 5 hertz. And it was a way to try to recruit the muscles, and I didn't know that that's what they did too, to try to recruit muscles, and then you could look at like repetitive stimulation, how well those muscles are working. But actually it kind of hurt to do that. I didn't realize that it hurt. So these little electrodes that are in there just measuring surface potential. Does anybody do that in their mice models where you actually stimulate with EMG, or you just pick it up when they move? What do you do?
I'm not working with mice, but
humans?
I know that people stimulate, but I don't personally do it.
Oh, yeah. It's made a nerve cuff.
Yeah.
Nerve cuff?
Yeah.
We stimulate the nerve with nerve cuff electrodes around the nerve.
Okay.
But we only use EMG to record.
Okay. Yeah. But I didn't know that's how they did it. I mean, so I think it would be nice. I mean, we get, seeing basic sciences, but what's actually used in the clinics would be fun too. Maybe we can get a neurologist in to talk a little bit about how they measure muscle. There was another really neat talk in the Grand Rounds while we're on nerve muscle that they were actually using the botulinum toxins in for blepharospasms and laryngeal spasms in here in the UK for that, and we just talked about it in the class, so it was really neat to see that being talked about as well, and some of the problems with repetitive use. Okay, so that kind of covers that stuff. So, let's see what time it is. So I thought what we could do is, so I highlighted a few things in the textbook that I thought would be really neat just to go over to kind of review things. So here, the take home on this EMG gives you information of activity patterns, but be careful of even determining it for muscle force, which some people were doing with muscle force, so that doesn't give you a very good indication either. The chapter summaries, if you have your book, I think they're kind of good. They give you an overview of the chapter a bit. I'm going to type up a little sheet of some of the bullet points that we've covered over these two chapters, just so it kind of refreshes your memory on certain aspects. Be helpful for me, too. Okay. So what I thought I would do here is go through some of these main things that we've talked about here. I'm going to work backwards on the chapter. We've talked about the different staining patterns. This was interesting, about just as a note here, 80% of the muscle fibers that M-band produced a really good fiber typing, so that, like we talked about, but you'd have to really be able to see it well, unlike myself. We talked about that enough. Ken said that he would talk about muscle skinning and permeabilized muscle fibers for looking at muscle contraction, where they actually make holes in the membrane so they can pick the muscle fiber up and move it over, and change like the calcium bath in the muscle fibers. We talked about the staining. Just want to, something else that was in here. Yes, we talked about that. Well, these gods in the field, we know about Hill and cats, right? Bernard Katz and A.B. Hill studying muscle fiber types, and they did this in so many different animals as really as comparative physiologist in understanding the effects, like the how muscle fibers contract, and early on, even in electrical activity. You know, Bernard Katz got the Nobel Prize for the shape of the action potential, actually. He also described the quantal release of synaptic transmission, worked on frog muscles, worked on crayfish muscles, and it was really quite interesting how he did that. We know the banding patterns. And there was something else. We talked about that. I'm going back to chapter one real fast. Just want to make sure that we talk about some of these main points. I think there was something else I was going to talk about. Contraction. Oh, yeah, we did talk about the development of muscle fibers and innervation patterns on muscle and development of the muscle fiber types, right, with innervation and thyroid hormone being important as well as determining muscle fiber types. If you don't have thyroid hormone, your muscle fiber types don't differentiate well. And that's the same, actually, even in amphibians and other animals, reptiles as well. Thyroid hormone is very important for muscle differentiation. So that's kind of a neat point. But that the fiber type is not completely determined by the activity patterns on those motor neurons. So the early studies where they crossed, innervated fast, like a fast motor neuron, slow motor neuron, to fast muscle, slow muscle, and they cross-innervated, right? So they cut the nerves and then re-innervate the muscle fibers. The muscle fibers would show a slight trend to switch fiber types, but they wouldn't completely switch over. So it wasn't just the nerve then controlling that fiber type to change over, but you could take a fast muscle fiber repetitively stimulated and it would start to look like slow muscle, but it doesn't completely convert. And this is that little snippet that was in your text that's really quite neat. Let me see if I can find that again. I thought it was an interesting point. Maybe it was back here, actually. It was these little black boxes that are in your, or gray boxes that are in your text are quite interesting because it makes you think about something. Oh, yeah, I forgot. I was going to pull up something about this. I know it sounds chaotic, but it's really not. Oh, here we go. Nope, that's not it, I don't think. It was about if you're a sprinter. It's really neat. Well, we did talk about muscle pain, right? Somebody mentioned that before, right? It's not from lactic acid buildup, right? It might be calcium. Right? Have we heard about that before? And if you use a calcium channel blocker, you can actually block some of the pain that's in your muscle fibers. But I really wonder if it's hitting the motor, the sensory endings that might detect the pain, or if it's really on the muscle itself. You had a question?
Yeah, what you were talking about, is that the axoplasmic theory?
Yeah, I think that's what they call that. Right. So if you keep activating, here it is. Oh, good, I found it. Page 73. So if you're a sprinter and you keep running all the time, right, you can start to switch those fast muscle fibers to a slow type. So you'll actually exercise your muscle, but you're going to become slower by training. So it's kind of interesting to think about. If you're a sprinter, maybe there's a limit to how much you should be running, because then you would actually convert the fibers and you would become slower. So it's kind of neat to think about. Larger fibers are also fast types, the more appropriate state for sprinters. So fast based on large
physical cross-sectional area that result in their muscle architecture. In fact, as sprinters train at high speeds, their muscles become stronger, but intrinsically actually become slower. So that's kind of neat to think about. So you wonder about how much you should be training, right?
Is it not the transition from fast fatigable to fast fatigue resistant?
That might be it right there. Yeah. So, yeah, and if you're kept training, that's probably it. And you probably heard of people, I don't know if they do this anymore, maybe they do. You know, a long time ago in Russia, for example, they would actually fiber type young kids, like in middle school or so, and they would take muscle fiber types, and they would actually then look at if you had genetically more fast muscle fibers, they would train you to be fast. And if you had more slow muscle fibers, they would train you to be a long distance runner. And they were actually doing that, and you think, well, that's kind of chaotic. But then you don't really want a sprinter trying to run marathons, right? And you don't want a marathon runner trying to run sprints. They're just not going to do it. But I don't see why you just don't get them on the field and see how good they do. But do they still do that? I mean, do they do that at all in the States? I mean, do people do that kind of thing?
I don't know about kids, but they, a few years ago, a guy at Ball State did a study with a world-class sprinter that showed a makeup of very high percentage, well, I say very high, but yeah, 23% type 2X fibers and then a high percentage of type 2A as well. So it was, depends on the athlete. And, you know, they can be genetically predisposed or he couldn't really give a reason why he had such a high percentage of type 2X. But,
neat.
And then, you know, they've also done with long distance runners showing that in the 70% of type 1 fibers.
All right. So there's
a multitude of factors.
Very good factors. And I think your text is kind of pushing for some of the genetic components as well, that you can't really change the genetics that you have. But early on, with the motor neurons, activity pattern can push muscle more one direction. But even after you've established, that activity pattern could possibly change a bit of your fiber type, or at least like what you were just mentioning, maybe some of that pushover. So not on the pain. Well, there was another really neat little snippet in here somewhere, which I lost. But anyway, some of the other aspects that I wanted to hit on, which I didn't do last time, and that was these different disease states. I think I saved. Whoops. We will get that up here in just a second. Let's see if the internet's going to come up. Crap. Okay. I'm going to go blue. Guest. Oh, boy. So let's talk about Eaton-Lambert syndrome. Has anybody heard of Eaton-Lambert? Anybody know what Eaton-Lambert is? Eaton-Lambert syndrome? No?
I've heard of it, but I don't remember.
Asthenia gravis? Yes. Do we know what it's caused from? Maybe. Let's look. I saved these three different things I wanted to look up here. See if they pop up here. Well, let's see if I can get this. And myasthenia gravis. So myasthenia gravis here, neuromuscular disease. Basically these droopy eyes that people have, autoimmune disease, right? And, oops. Oh, goodness gracious, what happened? Oh, laptop, not computer. Thanks. Yell at me. So these droopy eyes that you can see over here, right? That's myasthenia gravis. And what does it do to? Autoimmune disease, antibodies to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. So those are your receptors at your skeletal neuromuscular junctions, right? I think I sent it to the class. I'm not sure about the movie that was coming out with Brain on Fire.
I went and bought the book because I wanted to read it.
Isn't that amazing?
That. It's crazy.
You start reading that book and you can't put it down. Brain on Fire. And my daughter's went through the physical therapy program here, and she's up at Children's in Cincinnati. She can't say who or anything. But they just had a case with a young kid that was actually just in the young teens that actually had this same
antibodies to the NMDA receptors, and they're doing the physical therapy on her to try to get her back functioning again. But they actually misdiagnosed her for a good while before it was actually diagnosed correctly. So it's, you know, these are still going on where people don't expect these kind of things to happen.
My grandfather had this.
Did he? Okay.
He was diagnosed late in life, but it kind of, an interesting, we talked to his doctors who said that when he got older, it kind of manifested. He was okay with it, and then it kind of dropped off, where he like had no control over his upper body at all, or his legs and stuff like that. So it was interesting that it sort of all kind of came to a head. He had other disease processes happening as well that probably contributed to
it. Pretty debilitating. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't understand why. I guess maybe the treatment, I don't know, the clinical treatment, did they just do plasmapheresis and get these antibodies out now, or is it some way to...
He was on oral medication. Okay. I can't remember the exact...
Acetylcholinesterase. Try to keep more acetylcholinesterase. But you would think if you're making antibodies, get those bloody antibodies out of there, right? And, you know, it's very bizarre. Maybe this is, you know, kind of where we are still in the old-fashioned ways of doing things. And so Eaton-Lambert syndrome is another autoimmune disease, and it causes muscle weakness. So you might go to a neurologist because you're starting to trip, you know, and you're weak, like going up the steps. It's like happened to me when I went and actually met a neurologist because I was going up steps and I used to run up, and every once in a while I was just tripping. And I thought, what the hell's going on? That brain tumor, you know, all these things go through your brain, right? And it came out because I always sit in my wallet, but I was pushing on my sciatic nerve. It was just what they call like a wallet syndrome. I thought, I don't have that much money in there, but it's all these other little pieces of paper that you keep in there all the time. And it would push on that nerve, so he said, you know, get all that extra paper out there, but I still put my wallet in. But sitting on it all day long can actually pinch on that nerve and can cause problems. So, of course, I thought I had all these different diseases and I was freaking out. But this is an antibodies to the voltage-gated calcium channels in the nerve terminals. And it usually comes out that you might find out that you have some muscle weakness. So then you go to the doc, and then they do all these different tests on you. And then they find out that it's not your muscles that's the problem. It's actually the nerve. And then they do this staining. They now have an assay, they can actually look to see if you're making these antibodies to know if you have an Eaton-Lambert syndrome or not. And then they know, oh, this person probably has a tumor in their lungs. And so most of the cases really appear with a tumor in the lungs. And they look then for it, but the tumor can be so small, this neurologist will tell me, don't worry about this, Cooper. It's not this. It's really this other thing from sitting on your wallet. And they look for it, and sometimes they can't actually find the tumor until they actually image really high image resolution on the lungs, but usually they can find it, and then they just remove the tumor, and it all goes away. So your lung tissue is making these antibodies from that tumor that then it hits your voltage-gated calcium channels in your nerve terminal, and then you have muscle weakness from that. So that's kind of interesting to think about, too, some other disease states. And then the last one I just wanted to, that I saved was your botulinum toxins, just so that we've heard about it. There's actually, let me see if I can find that thing. There's so many different classes. I think it's A through H now. Because here's your vesicle in your nerve terminal, the presynaptic membrane right here. Different botulinum toxins hit different proteins right here and can cleave those so your vesicles can't fuse. And so when people are getting these treatments, for example, they might have this muscle weakness. Hopefully it's localized, like if they're giving it for blepharospasm or laryngeal spasms. But I think we talked about that before, that Florida case, where the physician got... Did we talk about that in here? No? Where a physician had a husband and wife team that they were treating for Botox injections, I think, to get rid of wrinkles, right? Some movie stars use it to get rid of wrinkles in the face or crow's feet on the side of the eyes. And so this husband and wife team that wanted to look better, I guess, for some reason, they were getting these botulinum toxin injections. They both died because the... I know these are all horrible stories, right? They both died because the guy, the physician, bought the Botox from not a normal supplier. He bought it out from Mexico, actually, and it wasn't certified. He wanted to save money and then, you know, scam them, the patients, and charge them more. So both these patients died. And there was a connection with our ophthalmology department here. Baker, I don't know if you remember him. He was here a long time ago, but he actually had an NIH grant with that guy. So it actually got UK involved in that whole situation also to figure out what was going on with that physician down there. So the idea is don't buy, you know, botulinum toxin off the, some black market. So it's bad, but it, hopefully it stays localized. And so, you know, these different binding sites, I don't know which one they actually use. I think it's both A that they use clinically, and I don't think they use the others. But, you know, you have to worry about breakdown of this, how if it stays localized or not, or if it gets out and can hit other tissues, that might be a bad situation. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Really, the regulation of this thing is crazy odd. So we had botulinum toxin A in the lab go out to the muscle weakness studies in osteoarthritis in rats. And the safety office wanted to know how much Botox we had.
Wow.
So and I said, well, it's 100 units because they regulate these problems by units. Mm. And I said, 100 units? We go, well, how much is it a unit? And I go, I have no idea.
Yeah.
How much is in the unit? And I couldn't find it. It's not in the written, you know, paper that comes out that folds out like a map. You read that thing. It doesn't say how much botulinum toxin is in the unit either. Mm-hmm. And so then the iguana found one study that went through Allergan and all these other manufacturers of botulinum toxin A. And the amount of botulinum toxin A in a unit varies across all spectrum of all these manufacturers. And these MDs are injecting one unit or 2 units into people's foreheads, mm-hmm. you know, irrespective of how much botulinum toxin is actually in those units.
Yikes.
And so like, we ended up canning that whole study because we had a big pain in the butt having the most brilliant toxin known to mankind in our laboratory under lock and key all the time. So
it actually has to be under lock and key. I think we still have some old stuff before there were these rules.
Yeah. And then when I got rid of it, I had to get rid of it in a way that was triplicate, right? So I said, can you guys come over here and tell me what I'm supposed to do to get rid of it? Yeah. Because, you know, it's pretty dry. As long as it's not reconstituted, you're fine. It's in the, but I had to put it in 3 different layers of
stuff.
Envelopes and containers and inject water and alcohol into it and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, hey. Bizarre things happen. And where was it? Oh, he might be that movie star that was in England that sued the doctor for the Botox injections? Because she was like a, what do they call it? You know, these, what do they call those shows? Like Days of Our Lives. Oh, yeah, soap operas, sorry. She was on one of the soap operas that, and then all of a sudden she didn't have any facial expressions. So it was so important to have facial expressions that they then canned her from the soap opera, and she had those, but she was trying to get rid of crow's feet and stuff, but that was so important to have facial expressions for the soap opera business, I guess. So, yeah, but, you know, imagine she's not the brightest person around.
Just as a side wrinkle, it doesn't get rid of your wrinkles or your crow's feet. If you paralyze your muscles, so you can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So then, I love watching the Academy Awards when people get up and they start talking and they smile and nothing else moves. That's how it's always Botox. We're not doing space anymore.
All the way. So that's kind of neat. So I thought, I know we don't have too much time, but maybe we can get started on it a little bit. We have, and then we'll talk about this on Monday too. And then hopefully next week, so let's, Monday next week we can cover these two papers, maybe some other aspects that we can look at as well. And then we were hoping to maybe get to go visit a lab and go do some stuff in a lab. And that would be fun to do as well, right? So something, get us out of here, hearing me yap all the time. So we mentioned about these two papers that we could start looking at. And it's really quite interesting. We don't have a lot of time to get into it, but this Norman Perelman, he's a machine. If you look him up, he's just like, I don't know how he functions, but when you start to realize where he is, it's Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and he's got money coming out of his ears with this Howard Hughes funding, that he can just, he just publishes paper after paper after paper. But he's actually done a lot of work in muscle as well, but he's well known in the fly genetic field. So he's done a tremendous amount with Drosophila systems and everything that you can imagine. He's a machine. But anyways, he was interested in the development of muscle and how it comes together. And if we could understand these processes, then maybe we could understand some disease states as well. So he looked at this in the Drosophila model, and the reason he used the Drosophila model is because the power of genetics, right? He can make RNA, use RNAi knockdowns. He can make crosses relatively easily where you could knock out certain proteins. But also, there's these systems called like a Gal-80. In the Drosophila field, you can actually then, with temperature, turn on where you can actually start to inhibit protein production or turn it on, for example, if you want to, under temperature-dependent processes, because you have these promoters that are temperature-dependent to either overexpress a particular protein or maybe turn on RNAi, that then you can actually inhibit certain proteins to be made. So it's just a very amenable system to manipulate temporally or genetically. Some of these genetic lines that they've made in the past, they were embryonic lethal, so they couldn't function as an embryo when they start to develop. But if they actually broke the little egg case, because they didn't have enough muscle to break the little egg case, so a Drosophila, they lay eggs, there's a little case around it, and they have to break out of that to then get out to then function. So if they don't have enough muscle strength, they can't break out of the egg case. So they could actually take off the egg case and let the little larvae, the little maggot, move around, and then it could develop. So when they say larval lethal or embryonic lethal, it depends if it was really not being able to break out of the egg case or not. But it's, you know, part of the definitions. But anyways, I think just the beginning part, let's just mention about this. So some of the models that they put forth about how a sarcomere builds, right, and how is it broken down. And you think about a muscle that it's in your body, and then you're building, if you're exercised, right, you're actually adding sarcomeres, muscle, you know, units into that functional muscle. So the muscle's working, but it's actually growing, right? This is a contractile element inside that muscle that's actually making your muscles grow, right? You're putting more of those contractile elements in there. So some of the models that he came up with to think about, one model is this IZI complex. We know what the I band is, right? With the actin that comes off the Z disc. So the IZI model, because the Z disc is in the middle, so an I on one side, Z disc, and I on the other side, right? Complex is this, and bipolar myosin filaments assemble independent before joining. So that these, the myosin would form, the IZI would form, and then come together. So that's one model. A second model supported by antibody staining and chicken cardiomyocytes was a little bit different. And so they fixed different times after spreading it in a culture system, so disassociated muscle proteins in the culture dish, and that these pre-myofibrils, let's see, they had a interdigitating banding pattern of IZI complexes, and the non-muscle myosins formed de novo, you know, new, right, near the cell membrane and develop into mature myofibrils. So that's kind of interesting. This model proposes the replacement of non-muscle myosin filaments with muscle myosin filaments occurs during the transition from pre-myofibril to myofibril, and that discrete aggregates of the Z bodies, right, those Z discs, along the pre-myofibrils grow and fuse laterally, right, into Z lines, so that they would then come together and then make these Z lines, you know, like a Z line going down, right, actin, 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 so Z disc, Z lines are forming together, yeah, actin coming off the side, and then that's how you can make these myofibrils. So that was another model. And the third model, and then I think we have to stop because class is out there. A third model emphasizes the scaffolding role of the giant protein titin, so we see titin now, during this myofibril genesis. And according to this model, the N-terminal domain of titin interacts with the IZI complex, and then the subsequent unfolding of the Z-terminal associates with the M-line, and then driving the interdigitation of the IZI complex to myosin. So that titin now is really important to line that up. Remember, titin goes all the way from the M-line, the myosin, right, the middle of the myosin, all the way from the M-line, all the way to the Z-disc, right? So that titin, largest protein in your body, right? So that's that other third model that he worked with. That's an acorn that dropped. Okay, and then the fourth model, let's just mention that and then we'll stop. The fourth model emphasizes this role of integrin adhesion complex in the sarcomere, assembling as the starting sites for the actin thin filaments polymerization. This model is supported by genetic studies in C. elegans and Drosophila. C. elegans is a little worm, right? In case you don't familiar. And a lot of work has been done on that. Again, a nice genetic model. And Drosophila in mice, showing that the integrin signaling pathway components are required for sarcomere assembly. So the integrins, right, important in there as well. So let's look at this next week and kind of go through just a bit of the staining patterns and how they came up with this. And it's really quite neat what they're working with, and some really nice figures in there. But it makes us start thinking about it a little bit. And then Esther DuPont Van Steeden suggested this. That was really neat. A paper that came out, a review on the mechanics and striated muscle from the molecules to sarcomeres to cells. So we could talk about that a little bit. It's going over some of the theories that people had about maybe some new ideas about how muscles contract, but then he kind of sets the limits to there too, and about some of the studies that couldn't be reproduced, which is really quite neat to just think about. Sound good? Everybody? Okay.
All right.
Great. How did my computer just turn off?
My favorite baseball player. No idea why.
Everybody?
Yeah.
What?
You know what a party meeting I eat all the Del Pizza and Big Lemay going for?
Well, that's bizarre. My computer just blanked
sorry,
out.
Sorry, I kept chiming in. I was going to.
Oh,
and
no, that's great. I mean, because I don't know where
for a conversation, that's why I thought, I'm supposed to be saying
let's see where we can catch.
That's right.
Perfect. So great.